At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste. So here's a little taste of all the delicious possibilities. Juicy, hand-picked heirloom tomatoes. Seared certified Angus steak over aged cheddar mashed potatoes. Or how about fresh dough, stretched by hand for every house-made pizza? Is your mouth watering yet? From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.
This is Matt Rogers from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Los Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
You know when people try a new food and suddenly it's like, okay, hold on, I got a new favorite food.
That's the reaction a lot of people are having when they first try Kewpie Mayo.
Yeah, it's the one with the red cap and the little baby on the bottle. You've probably seen it at the grocery store.
And this mayo is different.
Mm-hmm. Most mayonnaise uses whole eggs. Kewpie only uses egg yolks, which gives it this rich umami flavor. It's smoother, deeper, almost buttery.
Once people try it, they start putting it on everything. Egg sandwiches, fries, burgers.
Chefs use it. Restaurants use it. People who really care about flavor use it.
Put it on just about anything.
Then you'll understand.
Kewpie, the original Japanese mayonnaise.
Losing my Spurs. Gaza, the grief and the glory. The memoirs of a failed footballer is the new book out by Anthony Potts. It tells the story of what it's like to become a professional footballer, to almost reach your dream and then not quite get there. The memoirs of a failed footballer is the subtitle. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, the author of Losing My Spurs, Tony Potts. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good. Well, first of all, congratulations on having the, you know, the cojones, as we'd say over here, to call it, you know, the memoirs of a failed footballer. I mean, tell us a little bit about, you know, your journey, as the Americans would say.
Yeah, so my journey sort of began, like a lot of children, especially in England, where I just dreamed of being a footballer from the age, from pretty much as far back as I can remember. Everything I wanted to do was driven towards being a footballer. I was fairly obsessed growing up. It was all I wanted to do. And I was fortunate enough that when I sort of just left school, I got signed by Tottenham Hotspur. So I went straight from school to be an apprentice with Tottenham Hotspur. And I then got a 2-year professional contract with them. So at that point, I was kind of where I was wanting to be and where I'd dreamed of being, and kind of felt like everything was on track.
How old were you when you became an apprentice then?
I was 16, okay. So straight out of secondary school.
And so when you signed, did you think, this is it? I've earned my Spurs, pardon the pun. And you know, I'm going, this is my life has now got this direct path. I'm going to be a professional footballer. And obviously during the early years, you won the FA Youth Cup.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, we won the FA Youth Cup. We won the South East Counties League twice. We've won the Floodlit Cup. We won several cups as well, other than that at the time. I thought they were the biggest like youth club in the country at the time. So I kind of thought that even if I didn't make it at Tottenham necessarily, that I was going to be taking my living out of football.
And what's it like as an apprentice? Because I suppose most of us think that sort of footballers, they go to, especially in today's game, which has obviously changed an awful lot since you were doing your apprenticeship. But what's the day-to-day routine of an apprentice? Is it picking out which Bentley you're going to drive to the training ground? I mean, tell me a little bit about your background, you know, what it was like every day as an apprentice.
Yeah, unfortunately, it was before the Bentley times when I was the apprentice. So my job was more, we were there, we would be the first people at the training ground like an hour or 2 hours before the first team got there. We'd be cleaning the training ground, we'd be putting out the footballs, we'd be cleaning people's boots and putting them up, doing the changing rooms, like lots of jobs around the place. We would be training long after the first team were driving off in their cars. We'd still be training and we'd still be collecting footballs and going back to the ground for jobs in the afternoon that we had to do. And, you know, financially, it was, if I remember it right, it was like £35 a week was the wages at the time for when you was an apprentice. So, you had to love football. It had to be your dream to be really doing it at that point.
And Spurs was your team. What's it like as an apprentice when you're going into? I mean, it was White Hart Lane, presumably. Then was the ground, and you've got people like, I don't know, for example, Gary Mabbutt would have been around at that point, wouldn't he?
Yeah, Gary was there. Yes.
He is a hero, you know, a hero, whether you like football, you don't like football, you know, but, you know, when you've got players that are, you know, that are part of the club, that are legends in the club, what's it like sort of walking in and bumping into these people on a sort of day-to-day basis?
I think it was that kind of thing where it was hugely exciting, but terrifying at the same time. So you'd be kind of walking around, couldn't believe what you were doing, but at the same time, you were trying to make your way and be alongside these people and kind of be accepted as one of them almost. And yet at the same time, I'd be walking along and looking at, say, Paul Gascoigne or Gary Lineker, and just sometimes I'd catch myself just staring, staring at these heroes of mine. But then the next minute, I'm to go on the training pitch and go in for a tackle with them or try and beat them in a running race or whatever it was.
And so, you know, you're training with Gary Lineker and also with Gazza. What's it, you know, again, that day-to-day, because, I mean, it's the day-to-day lifestyle, isn't it? I mean, do you just look at them as just another player to beat, or in the back of your mind, are you thinking, you know, I'm going in on a one-on-one here with Gascoigne, this could be interesting?
I think when it was the top players, people like Paul Gascoigne, you were basically just in awe of them. So you'd spend a lot of time just trying to learn off of them because they were at such a high level. You just were looking, well, what did they do? How did they train? What little things did they do? Could I steal something off of them to improve myself? So you just spent the whole time watching them, trying to emulate them, trying to do the same things that they were doing in training, really.
And so you get into the Spurs squad, the first team squad, and also you get into the England youth team as well. That must have been, I mean, how were you notified of getting into the England youth team? Was it a letter or was it a call? What was that like?
Yeah, well, that was amazing. It was the end of my first year as a youth team player, and we'd just won the FA Youth Cup, and we were just about to go off for our break. So I'd booked a holiday to America, and then I had a letter come through saying that I was put into the shadow squad for the team, which meant I was sort of three people on standby to get into the squad. So I cancelled the holiday. And then next thing I know, I got a phone call through saying that someone had dropped out and I was going along to play for the youth team. So I was called up to the actual side. It was incredible. There was like tears in my eyes and a lump in my throat when I sort of was speaking on the phone, trying not to crack up as I was talking to the person on the phone.
So if you're in the squad but you're not playing regularly for the first team, are you then playing in the reserves? I mean, what was your routine whilst you were, you know, in the Spurs squad but not obviously playing in the first team?
Yeah, it was very much a game of like momentum. So they had probably about 50 professional footballers there with two teams that you could play for. So there were sort of 25 players every week who wouldn't get a game of football, who would train, and then when the sides got picked at the weekend, there just wasn't enough spaces for those. So while your momentum was going well when you were getting picked, it was brilliant. You'd be training a week, you'd have a game at the weekend for the reserves, and then hope to push on into the first team. But then if you, let's say you had an injury or you lost a little bit of form, it was very difficult to get back into it then because there was just no games. You just didn't get the opportunity.
And how did you keep your morale up? And presumably you saw players who were coming to the end of their careers or who were getting crocked and were having to drop out. And you must have been thinking, well, I hope that doesn't happen to me. And surely I must be coming to get my break at some point soon.
Yeah, well, right up to the point when it started to go wrong for me. But right up to that point, my momentum was going, and I'd had conversations with people like Terry Venables, who was saying that I should be looking to get in the first team. And so I was on a quite a steep rise for my first sort of two or three years there. And it really did look like I was going to break through into the first team at that point. So at that point, I could see other players dropping out. And you just kind of looked at and went, well, I've now just got this player in front of me now, and I've got this player, and this player is similar to me. So this is the one I need to try and get in front of next. So you were always kind of looking at the next step where you wanted to go to.
And for those who don't know their football history, I mean, that Spurs team of the early 90s, I mean, I mean, I remember watching the FA Cup semi final with, you know, with Gascoigne's performance on that one. But it really was, and as you said, Terry Venables. I mean, this is pre the heroics at Euro 96, but they really were sort of, you know, the team in London, weren't they?
Oh yes, definitely. And they played a certain style as well. They were known for sort of the flair. When I first joined there, Chris Waddle was in the team and Glenn Hoddle had just left. And then Paul Gascoigne came in, Gary Lineker came in. And I'd say we were just known for playing in a certain style of football. And it was exciting. It was attacking football. They played the ball around. They played a, you know, a real high tempo football. So yeah, I think that was everyone's sort of favourite second team almost at that time.
The book is also called Gazza, the Grief and the Glory. And you can't talk about Spurs in that early, you know, in the early 90s without talking about Gascoigne, because up until that semi-final against Nottingham Forest, if I remember correctly, he was the biggest thing in English football. And what happened after, and, you know, it's been, you know, his problems have been well documented, but, you know, it's called Gazza, the Grief and the Glory. And you struck up a relationship, didn't you, with Paul Gascoigne?
Yes, well, so I injured my knee at the same time as he did his famous injury in the cup final against Nottingham Forest. So we had our rehabilitation together at exactly the same time. So we would basically be coming into training and training alone, the two of us, getting ourselves back to full fitness. So pretty much every day I was spent just with him, basically, was my daily routine.
And what was he like? Was he approachable? Because, I mean, he was known as the. I mean, I'm just remembering, you know, going out because I was in my 20s at that point, and it was all. I remember him being the crown prince of football. You know, he was always the joker. What was he like? You know, was there an off button with Gascoigne, or was what you see what you got?
Yeah, pretty much what you see is what you got. Every day was a surprise. There was every day was something new was happening. Every day was. He was up to something. But the one thing I think that, you know, anyone who was around at that time would say as well was he took his football incredibly seriously. So that there wasn't an off button in terms of when he trained, he trained properly. He ran as hard as anybody. He trained. Well, when they finished training, they used to have to try and sort of say to him, right, Gaz, you need to get in now. You need to stop. If you get injured or you get too tired, because he just wanted to stay out and keep playing football. When he was in the youth team, If the first team finished training, he would often come over and ask, could he join in with us and join in with the matches with us? Because he just loved football and he was so passionate. And the other thing that people are always quite surprised is he was like a coach as well. So in terms of the younger players, he would often just pull a player aside and say, right, you need to be doing it like this. And look, when you do that, you should be coming off at this angle. He was very approachable to everybody at the club. And, you know, he was liked by everyone from top to bottom because he spoke to everybody as an equal. He didn't have any airs and graces about him.
The thing with Gascoigne is that when his football is finished, you have to fill the gap with something. And you could argue that, you know, when Gascoigne got injured, went to Lazio, and then his career sort of, I mean, he went to Rangers, etc. And since then, when he stopped playing football, he's, you know, there's been nothing there for him, and he's had, you know, he's had his difficulties. You had a dream of playing professional football, and that you got so close, you could almost taste it, closer than, you know, 99.9% of the universe will do. So when was, you know, what happened that made you realise that you weren't going to play first team football for Spurs? And, you know, that, as you said, that was the grief in your book.
Yeah, so... Well, when I went with the England youth team, I injured my ankle, and that was kind of the start of a run of injuries. And it culminated with I did the cruciate ligament on my knee, like the main ligament on my knee. So I landed and it just snapped. I can remember the physio trying to treat me with it and was saying, I'll tense your left leg. And I couldn't just do anything. It was like my leg was just dead. I couldn't lift it. I couldn't tense the muscle. So that was the main contributing factor to my sort of finishing as a footballer as such. But what then happened was when I came back from that, my knee was always okay, but the knock-on injuries from that, I never really got anywhere back near to the physical level I was at before. So I kept turning my ankles. My back started to give me some trouble as well. So I never really got a run of gains from that point onwards, from when I did my knee.
And it's, I mean, do you try and overcompensate? Because, you know there's something in, you know, there's competition for places. So do you perhaps overtrain? Do you, you know, right? Because, you know, you see people and there's always that thing, they came back from injury too quickly. Do you think, I mean, that obviously, because you want to play football. That's what you do. That's your dream. And to somebody to say, you know, give it another month, it must be absolutely frustrating.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing that in my case I did was, I ignored the other injuries because I was so desperate to just try and play and get back. So I had a 2-year contract. The first year of it, I was pretty much injured for. So I basically had 1 year to try and really prove myself. But my ankles, at that point, I probably should have had an operation on my ankles, but I tried to hide the injuries to my ankles as much as I could because I just wanted to be playing and have a chance to kind of prove myself. Because I felt that if I had the operation on my ankles, it could be my second year could be over before I even was given a chance. So I didn't do myself any favors. I tried to hide the things away. I tried to just get on with it and sort of battle through. And really, I should have spoken to people and said, look, I'm having trouble and I do need to get this sorted.
And when did Spurs let you go? I mean, and was that, I mean, that's your dream and you've been there and you've been training and you've almost got there. Was it a conversation? Was it a letter? And what did you do immediately afterwards?
Well, it was a conversation, but not even really a conversation. It was almost an in passing comment kind of thing, like just a quick, we're not going to be renewing your contract at the end of the season. So we're just going to give you that notice so that you can arrange like somewhere else that you can go. And it was pretty much just left to me. So from that point onward, the last year I was there was one of the hardest things I've ever had to go through, because I was going into training knowing that the people at training didn't really believe in me anymore or didn't really think that I was part of it anymore. And then at the same time, I had no one really in my corner saying, well, here's a trial hero. I know someone here that you can go and train with. So I had to get on with it myself and try and arrange some trials for myself, while at the same time, every day, just going into training, I'm just feeling like I was invisible. I just felt like I was invisible. I'd walk into training and kind of, and it was the same place where, you know, a year and a half before, I'd felt like the king of the world almost, you know. It was such a contrast, such a tough thing to do.
And did you have a manager at this point? I mean, or were you looking after yourself? Because I'm just thinking about, you know, surely if you had somebody with you, did you start looking immediately for other clubs, maybe somebody, you know, in what was then presumably, you know, the second division or the first division, which is now the Championship? Or was the injury, you know, did you have somebody who was going to help you look for another team?
No, I had an agent when I first signed for Tottenham. An agent just phoned me up, and they knew about me getting my professional contract before I did. So I found out I was going to be a professional footballer from an agent ringing me up and telling me basically before the club did. So, but when things didn't start going very well, that agent just disappeared. So he just dropped me like anything. I didn't return phone calls or that kind of thing, because all of a sudden I think his tactic was to try and get as many young footballers as possible and hope that one of them hits it big enough that he's going to make a little bit of money out of it. So he definitely, when he saw that I was being released by Tottenham, I didn't get any help at all. So I arranged a couple of trials myself. I got in touch with two like local sides like Millwall and Charlton, and I arranged trials for myself at those clubs. But if it hadn't been me doing that, I'd have just basically seen out that last year, just coming in every day until my contract finished.
So when did you decide that, you know, your playing days were over? What was what was your final kick of the ball in anger, if you like?
Well, I think my final one was, so I'd left Tottenham and I tried to get back into football, going through non-league football and kind of work my way back up that way. And I just wasn't enjoying it. I still had, my ankles were still playing me up. I was having to wear strap-ins, and every game I was worried that I was going to turn my ankle again. And we were traveling somewhere. It was a midweek game, and we were traveling to somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and it was raining, and I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to go and play. And they announced on the radio the England squad, and the England squad had four players who I'd been training with like 2 years previously. I'd been in the same side as. And I just sat there and thought, I just can't do this. And it was just that moment where I was just, I can't carry on with this. It's kicked me enough now, sort of thing. Mm. I was mid-20s at that point. And I think when I got back from that game, the next morning I signed up for teacher training at the university near me and decided that that was it.
Yeah, but I mean, at least the main thing is that you went off and you did something immediately, because it would have been very easy to be another, because we only see, don't we? We only see, as I said before, the baby Bentley drivers and the, you know, the £1 million footballers. And I know it's a little bit before all the massive cash comes in, but there are hundreds, if not thousands, of young men and women who want to become professional footballers who never quite make it. And a lot of them just become, just sort of give up at that point, don't they?
Oh yeah. I think it's, as part of my motivation for writing the book, really, I wrote a blog sort of touching on this slightly, and I had loads and loads of responses from people before I wrote the book. And the responses were from, I had a 12-year-old child who'd been dropped from his Sunday team, but he'd always dreamt that he was going to be a footballer, and all his friends had come through this football team and he was finding it really difficult. And then I had friends who I played football with who ended up actually, I felt, having really good careers in the lower leagues, but they've been professional footballers the whole time. And they were telling me they never actually got over the moment they were released by Tottenham. They never, despite the fact that they had a whole career, they never got over it, and it had haunted them since. And even down to, you know, when you use Paul Gascoigne as an example, I think that's exactly the same with him. Despite the career he had and the caps he had and the fame he had, when football was taken away from him, that's his identity gone. He, you know, I don't think he really knew who he was without football. And I think that happens to a lot of people. I think if you put all your eggs into one basket and you just identify yourself as this person. So my whole life I'd been Anthony Potts, who was at Tottenham, Anthony Potts, who was at Charlton, Anthony Potts, who was this footballer, Anthony Potts, who was going to be a footballer. Then all of a sudden I was meeting people and I was embarrassed to even talk to them, because I was like, well, how do you see me now? What do you think I am now? I don't even know who I am now. So I think if you put everything into something as much as you have to try and get to that place, when it goes, it's the hardest thing in the world. You just don't really know yourself anymore.
And there's a conversation to be had about that, isn't it? About how we, because as a young footballer, you are plucked at an incredibly early age. And we see it even now, you know, people coming through, you know, they're all talking about, you know, players being plucked, you know, he's been in the youth system since he was 13 or whatever, which is great when it works out and you get a Mason Mount or whatever, or a Billy Gilmore. But for the hundreds of others, you know, they've got no backup plan, and they've never known anything but this, and they've always been told they're going to be great, and they can, you know, when you're 12, 13, all you can see is you scoring, you know, the winning goal in the World Cup final.
No, exactly. I mean, I've seen a lot who really have gone off the rails at that point at various stages as I went through. Some people, because I think what kind of happens sometimes is they look for an excuse to save face. So you see people who kind of, oh yeah, I didn't make it because, oh, look at me, I'm out doing this and I'm getting into this, and they kind of try and put a reason in the way rather than just, because sometimes it just hasn't worked for them.
So writing the book, I mean, I know you've written before, you've written Eye on the Ball and Star on the Rise. Yeah. So what was what was it like putting this one down then?
It was like therapy a little bit at times. I was writing it. It felt a little bit like I was getting rid of a few of my demons a little bit as I was putting it down. Obviously the first people I got to read it were family, and that really hit home for me as well, because my family's reaction was just, they never knew what I was going through. They just didn't have a clue. My mum said she had to read it with a box of Kleenex next to her, because she was reading it and she was just going, oh, my poor boy, because she just didn't realise what was happening or what was going on inside with me.
But when you look back at it, I mean, are you thankful for the time that you had there? I mean, and because obviously now, as you said before, you went to, you know, you're a published writer, you've done this sort of thing before. I mean, can you look back and be satisfied with the fact that, you know, where you are now?
I feel happy. I feel content in the life I have, but I don't think I would ever quite lose that, you know, what if, ever so slightly. The odd thing happens still, and I kind of go, oh. I mean, one of the things I talk about is I have a recurring dream, and the dream, if I wake up from this dream and I remember it, 9 times out of 10, the dream will be me having a football trial somewhere, and I never get there. It's my dream. It's like I turn up and I haven't got my football boots, so I turn up and I'm at the wrong place, or I go out to find the pitch and I can't find the pitch. And it's a recurring dream. So I don't feel like I'm focused on it or that it's haunting me. But then when I have a dream like that, I think, well, deep down, it must still be there. You know, like it's never quite gone away, possibly.
And given that, you know, given the high profile that footballers now have, because, I mean, this is the early 90s, so this is before social media, were you kind of quite relieved that you weren't, you know, in the game when, you know, everything that you seem to do is recorded and put on the social media and makes the headlines? Because, I mean, Premiership footballers were made the headlines, but not in the way that they do these days.
Oh, definitely. I think I would have found that very hard. You know, every sort of criticism is tenfold because you're reading about it everywhere you go. You know, your private life. I mean, it was fun. It was fun to be a footballer back in those times. And I wonder sometimes when I see it now whether, you know, the footballers are having quite as much fun as we did at the time. You know, you turn up for training and it was like playing football with your mates still. You were there and wasn't quite the intensity from outside on you. So when you turned up the training ground, there wasn't really many press around. There wasn't many people around. And people just loved playing football. You know, there'd be little fights and things in training, but it never got blown out of proportion. Everyone would just come in the next day. Whereas now, that would be all over social media that, you know, two players have had a fight in training or that someone had fallen out with someone. You know, it was a time when it was your dream, but it did feel, it literally felt, every day I went into training, it felt like I was still a kid in the playground.
The book is called Losing My Spurs, Gazza, the Grief and the Glory, the Memoirs of a Failed Footballer. It's by Anthony Potts, who we've been speaking to today. Tony, if people want to find out more about you or the book, where can they go, please?
I've got my own web page, so I've got my own author page. So if you look up for Anthony Potts, you'll go straight to my website and I've got all the links to everywhere that you can get the book for. The book's also published with Pitch Publishing. And so if you went to their site, you'd be able to find all those details. And I'm on Facebook and Twitter and all the usual social medias. So,
And it will be available as a virtual download from our own bookstore. The book is called Losing My Spurs. It's by Anthony Potts. Tony, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. I've really liked it. Really enjoyed it.
At Market District, we believe in the power of great taste, like juicy heirloom tomatoes, cheesy house-made pizza, and fresh artisan-made bread. From produce to meats to chef-made meals, discover great taste at Market District.